Thank you for listening to our Conversations About Change, bringing thoughtful perspectives on technology, society, and change to the net every week since October 2004. Here's this week's show. Welcome to the 309th Yitan Tech Community Call on Monday, December 20th, 2010. Yitan means Conversations About Change in Mandarin, which I do not speak. I'm Jerry Mikulski, Yitan's founder. Today I'm in San Francisco and my co-founder, Pip Coburn, is in New York. Every week, we take 30 to 45 minutes to discuss tech topics of interest to investors, executives, and tech-savvy folks like you. You can find supporting resources online at yitan.com, that's yi-tan.com, as well as links to a live chat using IRC. We use Yitan without a hyphen as our Twitter user ID and as a hash code, too. We also podcast, so you can listen to these conversations when you want to. This is an interactive call, which means we are all live. Please be mindful of this and don't put us on your musical hold. Instead, mute buttons are just fine, or hit the star 6 on your keypad. When you want to jump in, the star 6 will also uncloak you, and then please say your name each time so we know who's speaking. Today's conversation about change is about complexity, and our guest, whom I hope is joining us, is Dave Snowden. Dave, if you're on the call, speak up. I cannot hear you at this point. And if not, we can have a conversation about Dave's Kinevan framework and about managing and complexity and so forth, and reschedule with Dave for a later date, but I'm confused because he pretty clearly understood that this was the time. So I'm thinking there's something else afoot. So let me start by hoping that you all read up on the Kinevan framework. I had sent a little bit of homework, which was two videos and then an HBR article in which Dave and a colleague explained the Kinevan framework and its use in management. And I was at an event recently where I got to hear Dave talk quite a bit. He had a couple of speaking slots, and then he answered a lot of Q&A and so forth and participated in discussion. Then every time he would talk, I would fill a sheet of paper with notes and really focus on what he was talking about. And what we wanted to talk about here was the difference between complexity theory, chaos theory, and systems theory, and how, as Dave says, these things were often conflated or confused or mixed together. And I'd rather not go into that part of the discussion without Dave on the call, but I would like to talk about the Kinevan framework and its role. And Kinevan, I guess one translation of the word Kinevan, which is a Welsh word, C-Y-N-E-F-I-N, is the place of multiple belongings. And if you've got any of the pre-readings, or if you just want to look up Kinevan online and find the diagram, it'll be handy for you during this call to have the Kinevan framework in front of you.
Dave Snowden.
Dr. Snowden. It's Jerry Mikulski here. Thanks for joining
us. Hi, Jerry.
We were just hypothesizing that you were snowed in at Heathrow or something like that.
No, I'm snowed in Wiltshire. I wouldn't even attempt to get to Heathrow at the moment.
Excellent.
4 inches heavy steadily outside at the moment.
So let's dive right in. I was just starting to talk briefly about Kinevan, and I believe one translation of it is the place of multiple belongings. Actually, before we go into complexity and chaos and systems theories, what's the birth story of the Kinevan framework itself? How did you bring together the different kinds of ideas that form the framework and that clearly aren't a 2x2 matrix? I think you very intentionally make this a messy diagram, which is very useful in a world overcrowded with 2x2 matrices. This is actually a lovely framework. So how did it come about?
You didn't know the fight I had with Harvard Business Review to stop them making it a 2x2 matrix and renaming it.
I noticed the illustration in the HBR piece even is turned at 45 degrees. It's a diamond, not a square, intentionally to not be a 4x4. I love that.
I prefer the main one, actually. But I actually wrote this in a series of 7 blogs, which are published on the website, so people can go into more detail there. But it starts off in knowledge management over a decade ago. Whereas reading some of Max Grasso's work in Knowledge Assets, mm-hmm. where he looks at abstraction, codification, and diffusion, and Max and I still do an awful lot of work together. And from that, I started to develop a concept to look at different types of community and different types of knowledge, trying to break away from the sort of tacit and explicit model, and that was the first Kinevan framework, which was published in an article which won an award or two called Complex Acts of Knowing. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I was working in IBM and started to realize it was a much more generic model of strategy. And that was when we were starting to bring complexity theory into play. That really hadn't come into play much beforehand. it became fairly obvious one mapped onto the other. So with some changes of language, the model developed. The disordered space in the middle emerged, and that's very important. The chaotic boundary emerged, which is also important. And then the whole sense respond type decision models were a reaction against some of the systems dynamics guys in IBM, who were published in a book called The Sense Respond Organization. And it was a classic, you know, systems dynamics, there is one solution to life, the universe, and everything type approach. And so I said, well, actually, you know, sense and respond is much more complex than that. We have different methods of sense and responding according to domain we're in, and then that got added in. And then Cynthia Kurtz, when she worked me out, did in the little network diagrams to talk about different organizational forms. So it was a sort of complex evolution over about 8 to 9 years. It also actually starts with the famous known unknowns matrix, which I created 15 years ago. But all of that is in the actual article on the website, which people can draw down.
Oh, awesome. Thank you. And known unknowns having been made extra famous by Donald Rumsfeld.
I briefed 2 weeks before he gave that speech, so I'm claiming the credit or the blame, depending on what you want to do.
Excellent. You have your place in American folklore through that.
I think there are better ways to achieve it, but I'll take that one.
So let's go straight into the notions of complexity theory, chaos theory, and systems theory just for a bit, because I'm very interested in, and I think all of us are curious about all these, and all of us have more or less knowledge about these different bases of knowledge. And can you tell us a little bit about how they get confounded and confused, and how we can straighten that out?
I think there are probably a couple of confusions which are wrong, and then there are some approaches which are different. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm in a polemical mood, I'll say they're wrong as well, but I'm feeling fairly mellow tonight.
Excellent.
I think we have two or three confusions. One is the confusion between complexity theory and chaos theory. You don't see that so much these days, but it was quite common a decade or so ago, and some people still use the words interchangeably, and for that's one of the ways you tell whether somebody's up to date or not.
Mm-hmm.
Chaos theory is the science of unconnected systems or random systems, and interestingly, I mean, you see a lot of this in physics. It's deterministic at agent level, but not at system level.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, chaotic systems are far more susceptible of modeling approaches. Because you've got a large number of unconstrained agents, you can build a model on that basis. Complexity, on the other hand, deals with systems in which the nature of the constraints and agent behavior are co-evolutionary. So the agents change the constraints as they interact with them, and the constraints restrain to a degree, but a varying degree, agent behavior. So you have many interacting agents, and they adapt, which is where complex adaptive comes from. Now, those systems, and one of the big distinctions we make these days, is fundamentally you can't model them. To quote Murray Gell-Mann, the only valid model of a complex system is a system itself, which is where we use narrative-type approaches. So we tend to talk about frameworks, and it's why I keep saying, you know, the Kinevin framework is a framework, it's not a model. It's a way of looking at a problem rather than an attempt to model the whole system.
Mm-hmm.
So the complexity-chaos distinction is a key one. There's an illegitimate split, as a lot of people make. A lot of the guys in systems dynamic, Margaret Wheatley, I just got an article from her, which I'm going to blog next week to illustrate this, uses the language of complexity, but uses it ideologically in support of a certain position, and doesn't really, I think, really understand the language. She's basically talking about things that she's always believed in, which, you know, a lot of them I believe in too. But complexity is ethically neutral. It's, you know, if you allow things to spontaneously self-organize, you'll probably get spontaneous combustion, which is not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the ideological component there worries me, and you see the same with Senge to a degree. So a lot of systems dynamics people like the language of complexity, but it would require them to abandon what they've done. You know, the sort of, and we can talk more about that later if you want, the systems dynamics to complexity distinction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the real difference is the whole systems dynamics, systems thinking movement focus grows out of the engineering period in management science, and it works off focusing on what an ideal future state is and then tries to close the gap.
Mm-hmm.
Complexity basically says you can't define the future, all you can do is describe the present, and the present has evolutionary possibilities. So it's a radically different, I sometimes say it's a non-causal way of thinking that a lot of people find difficult.
Yeah? Mm-hmm.
The other big distinction I'd make is between what we call computational complexity and cognitive complexity. Computational complexity is what's normally associated with Santa Fe and agent-based modeling. You know, birds fly around in the sky based on three simple rules: fly to the center of the flock, match speed, avoid collision. Termites nest and air conditioning arise from genetically encoded rules responding to pheromone traces and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people love that because it means they can build models, and this modeling obsession really worries me, but, you know, people do this. And I think the problem they've got is that people aren't ants, and you keep trying to explain this to them, and they keep trying to pretend they are because they rather like it because their models work.
Yeah? Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is human beings have intentionality. We can do things not in blind response to the rules, but we can choose to do things for complex reasons. We have multiple identities, and you know, identities are a complex emergent property of multiple roles. So the way we view and make decisions in the world will change according to context. And we also make decisions based on patterns, not rules. So we do a first-fit pattern match with previous experience rather than making rational decisions. And this is kind of like 101 cognitive science. So there's a whole group of us now, principally European, with a few people like Bill McKelvey at UCLA and others, who are arguing that human complex systems or cognitive complexity is a whole new field of study, because we have to take the insights we're getting from complex adaptive systems theory and biology and chemistry, and we have to combine it with the increasing insights from cognitive science into the way the human brain works. And interestingly, the overlap between biology and anthropology, which is a huge one at the moment. You know, we're starting to realize, for example, culture within one generation can change the chemical structure of DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And starting to realize that we're dealing with individuals are not atomistic actors. They're actually part of communitarian structures in terms of the way we make decisions. So that makes that a new field of study. So say three key distinctions: complexity to chaos, which is an old confusion, the misappropriation of language by systems dynamics, and then this split between computational and cognitive complexity.
Mm-hmm. There's actually a really nice op-ed piece in the New York Times, I think today, by Tyler Burge, titled A Real Science of Mind, in which he talks about neurobabble. And he's in some sense trying to draw a distinction between a lot of the fMRI neuroscience that's going on and then a more general purpose philosophy of mind and the role of psychology and other sorts of factors. But he's addressing, as you just addressed, one of my problems with the Santa Fe general approach toward complexity, which is that, you know, we're modeling ants and that'll be okay, or ants or swarms or whatever else explain a lot of human behavior. And Burge is saying that all this fMRI stuff is not causal, is not deterministic, is you know, might be a pretty picture of something that's going on, but it's at best an impressionist portrait of something that's happening at the same time.
Yeah, I agree. I think so with MRI scans is people are trying to identify linear causality in them, and it's not linear causality. And it's not all of it as well. If you look at the stuff on distributed consciousness, we know that chemicals are a key part of human brain structures, not just electrical impulses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the work, there's a wonderful book called Neither Brain Nor Ghoul by an ex-PhD student in the Churchlands, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Which basically argues that, argues without any question, that human consciousness is a distributed function of the brain, the hormonal system, the skeletal system, the nervous system. I mean, that's definitive now. So the old mind-brain identity arguments, where you had to either say the mind and the brain are the same thing,
mm-hmm.
Or you were a Cartesian dualist, which was generally held to be a bad thing to do and a sore sign you were about to join the Tea Party movement. Right? but we've now kind of like moved beyond that, and we know that human consciousness is distributed. But there's a lot of evidence now that we pick up phenome traces, for example. So our consciousness extends into our environment and also through our artifacts and our tools, which is why certainly I and quite a few other people are starting to go back to some basic anthropology. And if you look at the work on acceptation of John Erblinsky and other people, you'll see a lot of biologists are now starting to actually identify causal links between cultural change and biological change in humans and other systems. So I think we're now dealing with a much more sophisticated and, interestingly, much more simple, if you can change the way you think, world. The trouble is, it's not the way we've been trained to think for the last 30 or 40 years, so it's very difficult.
So what would John Erblinsky?
Odlin Smee.
Ah.
He's a guy, there's a key concept in evolutionary biology called acceptation. So adaptation is where a trait develops for a specific function.
Mm-hmm.
Acceptation is where a trait develops for a specific function, but then proves more useful somewhere completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And most major progress is exaptive, not adaptive. So human language, for example, is a result of exaptation. Lactose tolerance is another exaptive function, which is the stuff where he did his work.
Yeah.
Now this has major implications for strategy work, because you start to manage the ecology to enable exaptation, which is a very different approach to innovation. You're trying to stimulate some effectively serendipitous encounters. And again, the evidence supports that. Look at the invention of Viagra. It's a serendipitous encounter. It's never been replicated.
Mm-hmm.
Because Pfizer made the fundamental mistake, and I'll never forget the debates I had with them at the time, because I was about to join them. This is one of the reasons why I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Because they thought they could replicate, by instituting a process for innovation, they could replicate the serendipitous encounter at the conference, which produced Viagra. And they couldn't make this switch from engineering approaches to ecological approaches, which is fundamental.
Love that. Now, when you say this is about changing the way we think, what do you mean? How should we change the way we think?
Well, it depends. And we've actually had very little difficulty in getting the ideas across in India or China or the East, partly because, or Southern Europe. And I think one of the reasons for that is Taoism, Hinduism, and Catholic philosophy never abandoned the concept of non-causal systems.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Northern European, North American philosophy, with the only exception of the pragmatists and their important, did. So if you look in Taoism, there's a concept that some things just are. Mm-hmm. There's no reason for them to be, but they just are this way, and next way they'll be somewhere different. Now, complexity is backing up that concept. But the sort of engineering, Newtonian science, rational, atomistic type thinking, which dominates Northern Europe and North America, finds that very alien. We got rid of it from philosophy in the 17th century. In fact, there's a Western disease called fundamental attribution error,
mm-hmm.
which means if something bad happens, we always assume that somebody or something is responsible for it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas from a complexity point of view, it may just be an emergent property of a complex set of interactions. There isn't a causal link in the traditional sense of the word. So I often, when I'm working with executives, I'll often, really shake them up on that one up front and say, you guys have got to realize you're dealing with non-causal systems. And interestingly, the more senior and the more experienced, the easier it is to get that point across, because reality is kind of like thought limits. So that's one change of thinking. I think the other big change of thinking is switching from inductive to abductive
mm-hmm.
reasoning. So deductive is if A, then B. And if you look at sociology in the early part of the last century, we sometimes call this Selden Man, in tribute to Isaac Asimov and Harry Selden.
Mm-hmm.
Basically thought that they could create a mathematics of human reactions. That was very common thinking up until the 50s, early 60s. And we move on from that into inductive thinking, which says, this is case-based reasoning. I've got 500 cases of A, all of which contain B, therefore it's a reasonable inference that I will find B with A. Yeah? And if you look at it, most management recipes are based on that. Danger is it's hypothesis-based, and you get a lot of confusion between correlation and causation. Abductive reasoning, which goes back to the pragmatists, which, as I said earlier, is the greatest American contribution to philosophy, deals with the most plausible route forward. So this also links in with Faggard's work with concoherence and others.
Mm-hmm.
It basically says what you've got to work out is because the future will never repeat because it's a complex adaptive system, what matters is to work out what are the most plausible routes forward. And I'll come back to something else on that in a minute on resilience, rather than trying to work out what to do based on what worked last time. In fact, one of the kind of like key goals on this is we build worst practice systems, because in evolutionary terms, avoidance of failure is a more successful strategy than imitation of success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Also linked to another key concept, which is the difference between resilience and robustness. So in robustness, you try and prevent failure. In resilience, you say failure is inevitable. What matters is early detection and fast recovery.
So a question about that, Dave. I tend to take resilience to be, you can sort of bounce back to something, but you tend to bounce back into the same place as opposed to a word like plasticity or even a positive word like thrivability or flourishing, which I think opens more possibilities for actual change in the situation. I tend to see resilience as not being very open to change in the initial situation.
Yeah, okay. I wouldn't see it that way. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I think this may be a semantic difference. I mean, if you have fast recovery to failure, early detection, fast recovery, you always end up in a new position. Yeah, and the new position is part of the evolutionary potential of the present.
Mm-hmm.
Plasticity, I think, plasticity is a concept which underpins resilience, but you've got to be careful about the degree of plasticity. It's like the degree of constraint. That's the same principle.
Right, exactly.
If you basically have too much plasticity, you start to move into chaos. And remember, that's one of the principles of the Kevin framework.
Right.
Moving out of complexity into chaos is as bad as moving out of it into order, if you really want to move forward.
Yeah. So somebody just came on the call and is unmuted, so please remute your line. And I've got one or two more questions, then I actually want to open it up to everyone else on the call. What should we do to actually get better at all this? Should we rehearse a lot? Should we war game or role play? Should we simulate? Should we train? Should we learn a lot of hard and rigid rules? How do we make for a better populace and better colleagues to understand these sorts of things and react well?
Well, that's a 3-day lecture, right? That's high-level stuff on that. First of all, rigid rules are an ordered approach. Yeah?
Uh-huh.
I think what you've got to do is you've got to increase the comfort level with uncertainty. It's quite interesting. I do a lot of work in military environments at the moment, and military environments in time of war have much higher comfort levels with uncertainty than military environments at time of peace, yeah, for fairly obvious reasons. And although they still centralize command, they distribute cognition, and they can distribute command very quickly. Yeah? So flexible network structures is kind of like one thing. And we're doing work for the moment, for example, to take the military concept of a crew and use that in organizations. So people are trained into role and role expectation,
mm-hmm.
which means you can assemble a team from people who don't have to know each other instantly with the right level of diversity, and people will go into role for a period of time. Yeah,
it's a lot like the studio model in the movie business, right?
Yeah, yeah, and you can see examples in medical theatres and elsewhere. It's a very successful model, and it's much more economic than a matrix-based structure, for example, which is a systems dynamics approach,
mm-hmm.
which introduces two levels of inefficiency, yeah, or two bureaucracies, which compete with each other. So flexible structures, but you've got to put constraint in. Again, this is a difference with myself and Margaret Wheatley. You don't allow people to self-organize. You actually need leadership. Yeah? I mean, big mistake people are making is ideologically saying complexity means a leadership organization. That's total crap. Yeah, complexity needs leaders. In fact, if you don't have leaders, the alpha males will create one anyway, so you might as well do it objectively. Right? So that sort of flexibility structure within a constraint is key. I think the other thing is this switch from fail-safe design to safe-fail experimentation. Switching immediately strategically into small-scale experiments is much more important than spending time on design. Distributed cognition, which is what we do with the SenseMaker product, which can do whole-of-workforce engagement without the workforce needing to know what the strategic decision is doing. I mean, this is real wisdom of crowds rather than tyranny of thirds.
Mm-hmm.
So it's enabling large-scale participation in producing cognitive maps of the territory so that leaders can make decisions. So there's a body of new tools and techniques. And I say the big plus point on this, when people get it, is you spend less time managing. You've got more time to reflect because
mm-hmm.
you're not trying to micromanage or structure everything. You're managing your probes. You're managing your boundaries. You're running your safe-fail experiments. And you're monitoring and amplifying and dampening accordingly. So once people switch into it, it's a lot easier. But we've trained people out of this for 30 or 40 years, so it's a hard task. And the whole movement about MBAs and management consultants and 99.9% of articles in the Harvard Business Review are part of the problem, not part of the solution at the moment.
Mm-hmm. You have a really interesting take on raw data and the need to avoid boiling down, summarizing, or otherwise abstracting from actual raw data. Can you go into that some?
Yeah, that's what we do with SenseMaker. I mean, it's called disintermediation. Decision makers got to have direct access to the raw data. Remember when I was working on DARPA 15 years ago? One of the briefings I got from John Poindexter, who was the sponsor of all of this, and I'm prepared to defend him, by the way, if anybody's upset about that. I'm a good world socialist, but I will defend him. And the brief he gave me is basically when he was Reagan's NSA, if he asked a policy question, then all of the agencies would compete to actually abstract the information to actually achieve their own results, and so he couldn't do anything. So the brief we had was, how do you allow a senior decision maker to go directly from an abstract representation of the field into the raw intelligence data without any intermediation, and we built that. And now we're doing things like with, you know, the Rockefeller Foundation, which has published case in Nairobi, you know, just renewed that contract to understand people's attitude to development. And the key principle is the subjects of the research interpret their own research into a statistical framework. So you have a quantitative and qualitative approach combined, but you're always going from numbers to raw data without any intervention. Now, again, the approach for the last 30 or 40 years has been to assume, this is, I think, Google's error as well, that what people want is data summarized. They want less and less data, more and more focused on what they say they want. The reality is human beings evolve for serendipity. We want more and more data because we're better able to make the connections. So using computers to actually create visualizations for complex data sets, but not abstracting, not interpreting, not summarizing, and allowing human-based metadata rather than semantic metadata, which is also important, is one of the big ways forward. To give an illustration, we can, you know, a project a couple of years back, every 100th person in the store was given a product for free if they went into a booth and told a story about their eating and drinking experience. And then they indexed that by placing their story into four triangle shapes, each triangle at, you know, apex had a label. And that gives us 12 statistical data, you know, three for each triangle. And then we had a three-dimensional landscape on the marketing director's desk in which the horrors in the landscape represent strong beliefs or brand values and the peaks represent threats or opportunities. So the marketing director can now look at their evolving battle space, in effect, in real time, click on the model as it's presented on the screen, and listen to the stories told by their actual customers. So you've got statistical, yeah, you've effectively got the objectivity of quantitative data backed up by the explanatory and persuasive power of qualitative data. So say that's part of the sort of tool set we've built around this.
And this is the SenseMaker software suite you've got, right?
Yeah, that's it.
Cool. Let me go quiet for a second and invite other people on the call before I completely monopolize your time here, because I love talking to you. Let me go quiet for a second and invite other people on the call to jump in, say who they are, and ask some questions. I'm sorry about the unmuting thing, but I'd rather have us all on open mic with mute and unmute than do this hit one to ask questions sort of thing. Anybody?
Hi, this is Mike Nelson. This is Mike Nelson at Georgetown University. Being a professor teaching in a multidisciplinary master's program, trying to prepare our students for this complex world, I'd like your advice on how we need to change the graduate education business and the undergraduate education business as well. And if you have any programs you point to as models, I'd really appreciate that too.
That's a pet subject of mine. I've got a visiting chair at Pretoria University, and I keep trying to persuade them to do a completely different MBA. So if I talk about that, that will illustrate the concept. What I want to do is I want to get rid of all case-based approaches to MBAs, because I think they entrain past practice. So the one I've put together and designed for them, which if anybody wants to take up, they're more than welcome to, is you've got your core basic stuff like accountancy, legal, etc., which you've got to provide. But then to take undergraduate 101 courses in anthropology, psychology, philosophy, biology, I.e. a mixture of humanities, not social sciences, but humanities and natural science, at sort of first year undergraduate, some of what type level, and teach that for 2 years and then get them to apply that knowledge onto real world problems. So the idea is to give people what used to be called effectively, you know, the old British educational system in which you were expected to know lots of that many subject areas, which gave you more flexibility. And I think that would be a huge service. I also think managers would welcome that type of course. There's evidence that MBA programs are just producing people who are going to analyst departments, less people who are going to senior management positions. So I think the key thing in management education is to create a new generation of generalists, people able to integrate ideas. And I think with generalism comes the ability to cope with uncertainty. And a collection of specialists is not the same thing as a generalist. It's very different. I mean, my first degree is physics and philosophy. And it was an indulgence when I did it, but it was very, very useful because those two disciplines allow you to go into many others. But it also trains you to integrate ideas. Yeah? And I think that's what we're losing at the moment. People are looking for recipes, and they're expecting people in universities to give them recipes, not teach them how to think.
I think I've seen that. One thing we're talking about is T people, you know, the broad liberal sciences or liberal arts degree combined with deep specialization in one field where they really have all the tools. They can keep up with the best people in that field. But they understand the context in which they're working because, as you said, they've got an understanding of sociology, political science, economics, communication, how research and science is done. Mm. They might know enough statistics and computer science to be dangerous. But we find that our students have a hard time getting jobs if they're simply broad but not deep in any field. And they need something that they can, you know, some hat they can wear and say, well, I'm a web designer or I'm a statistician or whatever, with a broad background.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to see your syllabus and learn more about what you're doing.
Drop me an email.
There's certainly a need for a total rethink.
It's interesting.
Program.
Go ahead, Dave.
If you look at the British educational system at 18, we did A levels between 16 and 18. And if you were, anything between 2 and 5, depending on how bright you were. So physics, pure maths, applied maths, and geology. Yeah? But we were expected to have read every book that the English six had read, and we were expected to take part in the school plays and to know history backwards. Yeah. So, and what was interesting is because we were deep specialists, generally the old English A level was the equivalent of first year university in America. You knew what it was to know a subject deeply, so you knew your limitations and the other subjects you knew in general. So I agree with the two. I think the trouble is at the moment we're getting too deep specialist. So people don't go into one subject, they go into one aspect of one subject in one area. And I think that's also a danger. But they've lost this capacity to be curious and interested about history, politics, philosophy. I'd use philosophy rather than sociology, but that's an old prejudice and an old fight. It's that ability to think generally while knowing something in particular.
Mm-hmm.
This is Chris Allen.
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I'm also fascinated by this discussion in regards to education. In my particular case, I'm teaching in a sustainable MBA program where they've integrated sustainability into the whole curriculum. And why I'm particularly interested in this discussion is that systems thinking and complexity is definitely an important part of the sustainability movement, and I'm trying to also incorporate it in the side of social change, because I find when I look at your analysis of the different areas, I also see intervention strategies. Where to do things. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about intervention.
Oh, that's interesting. I think one of the issues here is interventions need to be contextual. Yeah. So you can come up with some generic things, like, for example, put in crews and get rid of the matrix structure, because you're building resilient capability there. You're building effectively loosely coupled systems rather than tightly coupled systems. In terms of specific intervention strategies, the way we tend to do it, to be quite honest, is a mixture of things. I'll give you a couple of illustrations. One is, you can actually use your research. If we use SenseMate as a research tool, we can also use it as a suggestions intervention capture device. In fact, we're about to do that in one big project. The problem with suggestions boxes is that people tended to put in a suggestion, but every suggestion had to be processed individually. On the other hand, if the suggestions are written down in Moleskine notebooks using Bluetooth pens and they're just sucked into the system, you can report anomalies and suggestions, 200-300 per engineer per day, for example. Then you can look for patterns in the way those ideas assemble, and a cluster of patterns indicates, for example, a new intervention. Yeah? So what you're trying to do is use systems to generate interventions bottom-up, right, at a much more fragmented micro level. Than you would conventionally. When we do strategy with companies, we tend to do it in a whole of workforce engagement over 2 days, with 400-500 people in the basketball court. This is not open space, because open space builds consensus and it punishes mavericks. So this is a much more structured approach. But then the corporate strategy is effectively 500-700 very specific actions developed by the people in situ. So you no longer have to have a communication strategy, a tactic strategy, because the whole thing is done in one. So I think the secret in interventions, and this is one of the different ways of thinking, is to find ways to generate and validate ideas from within the network rather than always designing them from outside or using them from elsewhere. And also to look at this synthesis of multiple patterns or multiple identities. Another project will illustrate this. We did this with Philips Lighting recently. It's up for a marketing award in Holland. We gathered micro-narratives from people across four European countries about their gardens and what they liked or disliked about their gardens. Then we took all of the core technology capability of Philips and got the engineers who created it to tag it using the same tagging structure we'd use for gardens. Then we mashed the two databases together and ended up five completely new service offerings, which were effectively technologies from silos that didn't normally talk with each other, but the software effectively integrated the ideas associated with real-world problems, and then that became effectively five coherent projects. So what you're doing is this bottom-up generation, but then you're linking, clustering, grouping, intervening, experimenting to move the things forward. You're not using recipes in the conventional sense of the word. And so one of the things we did in Canevian, for example, was generate these generic heuristics associated with interventions, you know, safe tail experiments. We have forms on the website which are open source. The software isn't, but the methods are, which you can draw down, which you can use in a workshop, which basically people complete to make sure you've covered up all the options. Because if you're doing a safe fail experimentation, you want it to be coherent. You want indications of how it would succeed, indications of how it would fail. You want amplification and dampening strategies worked out in advance. So, you know, it's a discipline type approach. But again, you're not using recipes. You're using heuristics and generic approaches. I'm not sure whether I answered the question up there, then, but that's a stab at it.
Do you find that you can use your model to help look at what kind of intervention is appropriate for a particular system?
Yeah, and one of the things we do when we work with a model in an organization is contextually designed to the company's own perception of its history and possible futures. So there's a social process by which the model is constructed using micro-narratives. And the boundaries and domains are effectively defined by the company's own experience and understanding. And that, for me, is very important. This is a contextual point. Too many models use examples from a limited number of manufacturing companies. And a big problem we've got in management science is all the examples come from manufacturing, which is a closed system, then get applied to services, which are open systems. And that's where you get disasters like Six Sigma, or as I call it, Six Stigma. Yeah, you know, because their engineering approach is based on closed systems that fail completely in an open system or anything which requires flexibility. So the model is extremely useful. It's best, it can be deployed as it is and just get people to put things into the domains. That's using it as a categorization model. And just say, okay, if it's in this domain, what are the safe fail experiments? That's really simple. And its most sophisticated thing, it becomes a sense-making framework, which is a 2 to 3 hour process, in which the model is defined by the organization from its own history and view of its own futures. And then it's much more powerful because it's easier for people to understand it and easier to find the examples.
Mm-hmm. Let's take
and that process is described in the History of Canevian article, by the way.
Thanks, Dave. Let's take a different question from somebody else on the call.
Mr. Karpinski.
Dick, go ahead. You've got the floor.
I'm hearing that essentially a lot of this stuff is about arranging to be humble and recognize that we don't really know all that much about the situation we're trying to improve, and so be open to learning new stuff.
Yeah,
did I get that right?
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. I think, but it's not humble in the sense of Uriah Heep, yeah?
Right.
And it's not humble in the sense of not actually assuming a leadership role. I think it's, I would prefer, I think, people who are humble are comfortable with uncertainty. Yeah, you need to be confident in yourself because you're going to have to take some risks, and you need to be open rather than going with rigid models. I mean, it's one of the reasons for this concept called disintermediation. If leaders can have direct access to raw data, they generally become more humble anyway. It's the process of surrounding themselves with staff who filter everything and therefore reconfirm their own biases, which makes them arrogant bastards. Yeah. So some of this is a surrounding process, right? But there is a time, and so this is the blog I'm writing, which is the Attack on Weeklies article. There is a time sometimes for draconian bastard leaders. Yeah, sometimes you need them. Yeah. not very nice, but you need them for periods of time. So we shouldn't try this one-size-fits-all model. Or once, you know, it's like the whole competence movement, which tried to define leadership competences.
Mm-hmm.
All the evidence from history is contradictory competences work in similar situations. It's not that simple.
Cool. Thank you very much. Let's take another question. We've got a little bit of time left.
This is Sal Ressa.
Hey, Sal.
Hi. Given your rooting in philosophy and the humanity that you talk about when you talk about people's reaction to models, we're losing a number of languages, cultural languages, every year. Are you concerned that we're creating a business language that really removes the art of language or the cultural arts of language?
Yes, absolutely. I'd love this audience, Jerry. You told me I'd like it. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most interesting things is we're destroying the power of metaphor in our language, yeah?
Yes.
And metaphor, I mean, I'm doing some work on battlefield command systems at the moment, and I mean, I like working with military because they're far more flexible and they're far more moral. I mean, if you kill people for a living, you tend to have better ethics than if you don't, ironically. And we're doing work on metaphor-based languages because with 2 to 3 words, I can reference a complex set of metaphors, for example, with counterfactuals, and I can convey very complex ideas very simple with huge richness but with enough flexibility for people to adjust in the field. So, for example, I'll give you the example I use a lot. I mean, when I was working for DARPA, I ended up being marched around every American Civil War battlefield. So I've seen everything by the ones in the upper Missouri now, and I'm now working, moving on to the War of 1812, yeah? And I've done the Gettysburg War twice, the whole 3-day one. One from a Confederate point of view, one from a Unionist point of view. Now, one of the key battles in that, you know, day two is Little Round Top, yeah? Because Gettysburg is accidental. On day two, Lee realizes the strategic significance of Little Round Top, sends a Texan regiment to the top, because if he can command it with artillery, the battle's over, and also the reserve army of the Potomac is directly under his guns, so everything is over. And a guy called Chamberlain, who'd been trained in the Midwest Military College with no military experience, realized the same thing at the same time, grabbed, I think it was the Pennsylvania Foot, but I'm not sure about that, marched them up to the top of Little Round Top, got there 10 minutes before the Texans, held it heroically in a bayonet charge, secured it, and it turned the battlefield.
Hmm.
So if I say Little Round Top, no Chamberlain, you see I'm taking a commonly understood teaching story, but then adding in a counterfactual, which makes it more sophisticated. So you can actually create metaphor-based languages with 20 or 30 fundamental teaching metaphors with 4 or 5 counterfactual points in each, and you've created a very rich language. Yeah? Also, I think English has natural advantages here, because English has 4 or 5 words for most things where other languages have only 1 or 2. Yeah? It's partly a result of the sort of Norman conquest and Saxon words being used in parallel with Norman words for 300 or 400 years. But that sort of subtlety of meaning we're losing because we're going for excess precision. And so now we're creating management speak, which only allows us to understand things we've already understood. And, you know, that's going to destroy Western competitive advantage if we don't watch it.
And when we're not going for excess precision, we're actually going for intentional vagueness, and we're in fact clouding over things that we need to give the subtlety to.
Absolutely. It's the dichotomy. I mean, the trouble is Western society loves dichotomies. It's like that total nonsense about left and right brain, which has got no basis whatsoever in any scientific fact. There isn't an emotional brain and a rational brain. There's an autonomic brain and a novelty responsive brain, yeah? But we love to put things in either or. So we have either, you know, it's a sort of Kantian thing. There are things we can empirically prove, or are those things which belong to God. In the modern day and age, there are those things which we can re-engineer to death, and everything else is down to inspired leadership. Now, dichotomies are really dangerous because they create these opposites. What we need is dialectics, you know, things which interact between the two, which use both simultaneously.
Incoming.
Go for it.
This is Doug Cohen. Thank you very much. I have a contribution I made years ago to the fantasy of leadership competencies. So I'd like to get your citations of where to look for those contradictory competencies.
Yeah, okay.
Whether here or later, just curious to follow that one up.
Well, I think if you look at, if you look at the work of Deakin in Symbolic Species, and indirectly, I think that destroys it immediately because it looks at the co-evolutionary nature of language. Freeman's How Do Brains Make Up Their Minds. I mean, basically, cognitive scientists don't even bother talking about competences. It doesn't even come into their framework. It's entirely organization. It's an It's an organizational development construct. Yeah? But Deakin symbolic species, I would start with. Move on to Freeman.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We've actually pretty much reached the end of our time, so I'd love to offer you a closing moment to add anything you'd like to this conversation. Then I'll summarize and take us out.
I think the only thing I say to a lot of people is, complexity is the new simplicity.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's rather like the 17th century. Things became simple, but a lot of people took 300 years to understand it and burnt a lot of people in the process. So, we have to think of this as a paradigm shift. You can't just do it incrementally, which means you've got to change the language.
Awesome. Thank you. Let me start where we started on the call today. So Dave jumped in and I asked him, well, what's the origin of the Canevin framework? And he said, well, there's seven posts on his site that you can go look at. And it really came out of knowledge management over a decade ago. He was talking to Max Brasser on knowledge assets, and Max was writing about structure and codification and diffusion. And a lot of this came out of sort of the knowledge world and this notion of tacit versus explicit knowledge. And Dave knew that there was a lot more going on there. So these were actually sort of, there was an article back then that he wrote called Complex Acts of Knowing, which was the start of all this. Then at IBM, he started realizing that this was really a more generic model of strategy, that it had much broader applications. And in that work, the disordered and the chaotic zones and all these boundaries emerged in the framework. And then he started realizing, he started also having some interactions with the systems dynamics folks, which tended to drive things toward one solution. Here's the way this works. And he realized that this really needed to be much more complicated than that. So there was an 8 or 9 year process in the middle of which he also created his known unknowns matrix sometime back where all this came out. Then we talked for a while about complexity theory, chaos theory, and systems theory, and the various confusions between them. And we started with the sort of complexity versus chaos, where chaos is really about unconnected or random systems, where there's deterministic agent behavior, but you can't, at the system behavior, you don't have that. The chaotic systems are susceptible to modeling. So this is where Santa Fe Institute and a bunch of others go in and start doing the modeling. And complexity is really the nature, it's evolutionary, so that you have constants, you have agents that are evolving and co-evolving as well as their constraints, not constants. And that many agents then adapt in this process. That's how you get complex adaptive systems. So you can't really model them. In fact, one of the famous quotes here from Murray Gell-Mann is that the only valid model of a complex system is the system itself. So you have to be able to look at these models. Then we talked a bit about the systems dynamics world and their use or misuse of language, where they've been using the language of complexity, but really having a different ideology. And Meg Wheatley and Peter Senge are sort of guilty of this, where they're kind of collapsing these different kinds of things. And Dave points out that complexity is ethically neutral, that you just have some conditions and things fall out, they evolve out of that, evolve and adapt their way out of it. The systems dynamics comes out of engineering and management science and is trying to, in some sense, design an ideal future and then close the gap between the present and the future. But he says in complex systems, you really can't define that future. There's the non-causal ways of thinking. And I meant to drop into the discussion at that point, the introduction to the Wilhelm translation of the I Ching, where Carl Jung does a really nice job talking about the difference between causal and synchronicitous systems, causal logic and synchronicitous logic. Then we talked about a third area of computational versus cognitive complexity, and Santa Fe really is a lot about the computational complexity, and they create agent-based modeling, and they model how termite mounds work, and there's really this obsession with modeling. But, people aren't ants. It turns out that we have intentionality. There are ways that we respond that are all contextual. We hold multiple identities, and then we decide on patterns, not rules, and very often we switch roles or we take strategic initiatives in the middle of all this. So he sees that the small group theory with the cognitive complexity might be a new field, and that we're starting to combine the computational and the cognitive and starting to learn from biology and anthropology and all the different disciplines and seeing where this might work. So we talked a bit about causality, and Dave mentioned a book, Neither Brain Nor Ghoul. The brain function isn't just, is chemicals and a variety of other things, not just electricity, that there's a lot going on here. And he's not very fond of Cartesian dualism, that really is a big distraction here. So consciousness is a distributed phenomenon. We can start looking at the tools of consciousness, and this is where you want to go back to things like anthropology to see what else is happening. John Olden Smee talks a lot about the exaptation, the notion of accidental adaptation, and human language is a kind of exaptation. And what you want in many ways is to manage an ecology to stimulate exaptation. You want to create environments within which a lot of people can create these accidental adaptations that jump to new places. So Pfizer, after inventing Viagra, which was very serendipitous, thought that this could be replicated. So they started creating a mechanism to create more things like that. They sort of misunderstood what had caused the innovation to come around. So we need to move from an engineering framework toward more ecological approaches for how this works. So this tends to be much easier to explain in the rest of the world, that a lot of other cultures, Eastern, Taoist, et cetera, understand this much better than our very cause and model obsessed American culture. And, you know, some things just are, as if you think about out of Taoism. So the rational atomistic notion finds these concepts alien. They can't see that there might be something happening here, and they subject themselves to a lot of fundamental attribution error, that there's something responsible for everything that happens. But it may just be that this is an emergent property of the systems that are at play. So non-causal systems are easier to explain, actually, to more experienced people. People who've got a lot of time under their belts tend to see that this actually makes a lot of sense. So we need to switch from inductive and deductive toward more abductive reasoning. And Dave briefly explained the differences between deductive, if A then B, inductive, inferring from a series of cases, which tends to be the way that management recipes really work. And there's a lot of hypotheses required here, but often there's a mistake that correlation equals causation. And then abductive reason, which is really the most plausible route towards the most plausible route forward. So he's looking at some of the work by Paul Thagard on coherence and trying to encourage better behaviors there. And we tend to build sometimes the worst practice systems rather than best practice systems, but that can actually be a productive thing. Then we talked briefly about resilience versus robustness, where robustness tends to be about preventing failure. And resilience is more about bouncing back. It's about fast recovery. And I asked the question, what about words like plasticity and thriving and flourishing? And Dave sees resilience as encompassing a lot of these things, as plasticity underpinning resilience. And too much plasticity actually leading to chaos. And this is a really important thing, is that you don't just want to have leaderlessness or complete openness, is that can actually lead to worse situations than before. So what do you do? Well, you need to increase comfort with uncertainty. And he finds, for example, he's done a lot of work with the military. The military tend to be more comfortable with uncertainty in wartime situations. They have more direct experience with what's actually going on that isn't unpredictable. But we need to build flexible network structures. He brings to mind this notion of crews in the military as well. Also, I think in the movie studio model, in the movie making business, where you have role expectations that are actually more economical than matrix management, which comes out of systems dynamics again, where people's roles are, you know, people can work with strangers because their roles are really well defined and they know how to play together politely and efficiently. So, you know, he says you don't necessarily want to allow that much self-organization. You actually need leadership. He then also recommends safe fail experiments, many of them, rather than fail-safe experiments. So something that is fail-safe is trying to be robust and trying to prevent failure, whereas safe fail experiments are ways of understanding what is happening in the systems around you, where any particular failure doesn't destroy the entire system. He talked a bit about distributed cognition and developing large-scale participation systems where large groups of people can create cognitive maps of the territory. Then managers spend less time actually managing and have more time to reflect on the safe fail experiments that they're running, et cetera, et cetera. I asked the question about raw data, and Dave says that disintermediation is one of the worst sins that happen out here. And, you know, decision makers need real access to raw data. What happens is that, and he gave the example of Admiral Poindexter back when with the Total Information Awareness Program, and he's happy to defend Poindexter's initiative here, because it turns out that when you're in a position of leadership with a big staff, all the agencies compete to abstract information to serve their ends. So you really wind up getting no information at all. So he's done some work with the Rockefeller Foundation in Nairobi to find out what's going on with development, where the subjects of the system, the people in the system, basically interpret their own research in their own context and create some of this raw data annotating it. So we want more and more data, and we also want serendipity. So, for example, Dave did a study where every 100th person coming into a store would tell a story about something they had eaten or drunk, and then they would map that experience into four different triangles that were basically four different three spaces. So he got 12 data points coming out of this, which a manager looking at this sort of as a product map, as a map of beliefs, could then drill down into so that they could hear the actual stories from the people who'd entered the store. So very, very small loop between the raw data and analysis of the data. Mike Nelson from George Washington University jumped in and said, hey, how would you change graduate education businesses here? And Dave said, well, you know, get rid of all case-based MBAs. That tends to entrain past practice. Tackle some core basics, legal, accounting, everything else in a pretty systematic way, and then have a couple years of basically the 101 undergraduate liberal degree, the old British educational system of anthropology, psychology, biology, humanities, natural science, and really then apply this to real-world problems after that. He says managers would welcome this, that MBAs tend to be tracked toward being analysts, but not senior managers, and we're tending to over-specialize. So we need a new generation of generalists coming out who can cope with uncertainty. His first degree was physics and philosophy, which was sort of serendipitous, but has really served him well. In particular, it helped him integrate ideas. So people tend to expect recipes these days rather than being able to think about ideas. And Mike Nelson pointed out the T-shaped people that a lot of companies are recruiting for now, or that some companies are, where you have depth in something and then a lot of breadth in a variety of different areas. Dave said, well, in the British educational system, you have your A-levels between your ages of 16 and 18, and that means that you're expected to have read every book in your discipline, know a lot of history, and to have attended and participated in all the school plays, for example. So you get this taste of what it means to know a subject deeply. Again, we're over-specializing. Chris Allen said more about, you know, he's teaching in a sustainable MBA program and looking at social change. What are intervention strategies here? And Dave says, well, interventions are very contextual. So he pointed out to the SenseMaker software that they've created. So you could use the SenseMaker application to capture suggestions. And he contrasts this with the normal suggestion boxes, where each suggestion is actually seen as a separate event or incident. Well, imagine if you had everybody in a laboratory using their moleskin notebooks with a Bluetooth pen, where every suggestion was sent into the system, and you could then see patterns inside the systems and then go directly to anybody's notes. So he says, use systems to generate bottom-up interventions of different forms. And, you know, he does corporate strategic interventions where he gets 400 or 500 people on a basketball court and then runs events that way. He's not a big fan of open space. He finds that open space tends to build consensus and punish mavericks in the system. By the way, I'm just on page 4 out of 6 pages of notes right now. So micro-narratives are really important. He's in one project, he collected micro-narratives from 4 European countries on how people view their gardens. And then they mapped this. And then he had Philips engineers actually tag their database of research and products along the same dynamics that people had about gardening. Then they mashed the two databases together, which led to 5 new product ideas. So not using recipes, but really trying to mash up raw data in different interesting ways. So creating safe-fail experiments is really important. You want some kind of coherence. You need some sort of discipline to go about it. So also important is to design interventions to the company's own context, history, and experience. Too many of these interventions are designed thinking sort of in a closed systemic way, which leads to things like Six Sigma, which Dave playfully calls Six Stigma. Dick Karpinski said, you know, isn't this really about being humble, you know, to being open to learn? And Dave sort of paused for a second, but said, you know, not humble like Uriah Heep, but really also not leaderless, that humility, you know, seeing all the raw data will actually give you humility. And you need to be confident in the middle of uncertainty, but you need direct access to raw data to get there, so that the staff filter can sometimes lead to arrogant bastard leaders because they filter away all the interesting stuff. But then he says, you know, you need room for draconian bastard leaders. Sometimes they are very appropriate. He's not very crazy about the competence movement, and he says the world is just not that simple. Sal Raza jumped in and said, you know, aren't we losing languages all the time? And is business removing this sort of power, this capability, because business is oversimplifying our language and crippling us in that way? And Dave loved the question and said, you know, we're destroying the power of metaphor here. He does, again, a lot of work with military, and he finds them to be extraordinary moral people because they're busy, you know, building things that kill people. So he points out that you can really, if you have rich language and rich history, you can then design quick counterfactuals that actually make things really interesting. So he talked for a while about having visited the Gettysburg battlefield and done the tour twice, one from each side's perspective, and talking about the battle for Little Round Top, where Lee suddenly sends his Texas regiment to Little Round Top, realizing that it's very strategic territory. But a fellow with no particular training named Chamberlain on the Union side realizes the same thing and gets he thinks the Pennsylvania military militia there, 10 minutes before Lee does, holds it against bayonet charges and turns the whole battle. Now, you can take that and change some of the facts, and then you have a rich language to experiment in. So English as a language seems also to be well adapted to this, because we have four or five words for most things. And in other languages, it's not as broad. This may be a factor of English having vacuumed up a lot of different cultures through the Saxons and other sorts of roots of the language, and Saxon plus German plus everything else. And it's happiness to borrow and incorporate other words. So we're, you know, going for excess precision is a bit of a problem here. It begets management speak. And I pointed out also going for excessive obfuscation does the same sort of thing. Dave has no truck with left and right brain theory and finds dichotomies dangerous and wants really dialectives. Doug Coam jumped in and said, can you offer some citations here so we can read some more? And Dave mentioned, I think, Beacon and Symbolic Species. And then Freeman, How Brains Make Up Their Minds. Dave, in conclusion, said, you know, complexity is the new simplicity. We need a paradigm shift. And my brain is full and thinking in lots of new ways. So thank you for this, Dave. That brings us to the end of Navigating Complexity, the 309th Yi Tan Tech Community Call held on Monday, December 20th. Thank you, Dave, and thank you all for joining us so wonderfully. Feel free to add comments and pages on yitan.com, and please tell your colleagues to join us again in two Mondays. We're skipping the 27th. We're taking off on holiday. But in two Mondays, we'll have another conversation about change. I'm Jerry Mikulski. Thank you very much, and goodbye. This podcast is published under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 license. It was edited and published by Sasha Mercailo. Thanks again for listening.